loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, the Winter Olympics opened yesterday in Pyeongchang, South Korea. In the shadow of difficult international politics, the sister of DPRK, that's North Korea leader Kim Jong-un, shook hands with South Korean President Moon Jae-in. She became the only member of the Kim family ever to visit South Korea. Meanwhile, Vice President Mike Pence, representing the United States, sat 3 feet away and never acknowledged the North Koreans. We'll discuss U.S. policy in the face of improving relations between North and South Korea. Then, in cities nationwide, longtime working class city residents face higher rents and increased pressure from landlords and developers. The nation's capital, Washington, D.C., is no exception. And two groups are taking the fight to a developer's own house this weekend with a march up a main D.C. street in upper northwest Washington. We're going to be talking about the demonstration, but more importantly, about the big picture as it affects gentrification here in Washington, D.C. and throughout the country. But first, we turn to the Winter Olympics. The Winter Olympics opened yesterday in South Korea in the shadow of difficult international politics. The sister of DPRK leader Kim Jong-un shook hands with the South Korean President Moon Jae-in. She became the only member of the Kim family to ever visit South Korea. Meanwhile, Vice President Pence, representing the United States, sat 3 feet away and never acknowledged the North Koreans. We'll discuss U.S. policy in the face of improving relations between North and South Korea. We're joined from Hawaii by Ann Wright. She is a retired United States Army colonel and a former U.S. State Department official in Afghanistan. She resigned in protest of the invasion of Iraq and became an anti-war activist. We're joined from New Zealand by author and professor Tim Beal. His most recent book is Crisis in Korea. And we're joined from Seattle by Professor Simone Chun. She is a fellow at the Korea Policy Institute and a member of the Korean Peace Network. Welcome to all three of you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
Professor Beal, let's start with you. It's 6 o'clock in the morning Saturday in New Zealand, so I think you should get first dibs here. I mean, it's pretty momentous. The fact that North Korea and South Korea could enter the stadium as a unified delegation under one flag. Of course, Korea has been divided since the end of World War II as a consequence of post-war arrangements in 1945. Korea had been a unitary entity for thousands of years. It's hard to overstate the sort of emotional or psychological and perhaps thus political impact of this development. Go ahead.
Yes, exactly. On the other hand, of course, they have marched together in previous Olympics, Sydney Olympics, I think. So this is not completely unprecedented, but in the present circumstances, it is obviously a big breakthrough. And it's certainly the North's participation and what it means for dialogue between North and South has been occupying the South Korean press over since the beginning of the year. So yeah, it's a big first step, but of course only a first step.
Let's go to Professor Simone Chun. Professor Chun, you are Korean, and I want to ask you what's the sentiment or the feeling among Koreans, there's the Koreans in the South and the North, overseas Koreans. Professor Beal is right. It's not the first time, but it's been a long time since the two Koreas marched together. What's the psychological or emotional impact of this?
It was just simply amazing. It was awesome. And it was so inspirational. And it was the fourth joint Korean march at the Olympics. And it was the first since Toronto 2006. And the we will see the more images and pictures. And I think the best part of this was that, you know, symbolism, sometimes we discount or, you know, we don't take a lot of credit to like all the symbolism and the imagery. And it was just the most beautiful thing that I ever seen, you know, in a long time. And it also basically destroyed a lot of doubt and also skepticism and all the people who were, you know, just saying this is going to be Pyongyang Olympic. And you remember all those horrible campaign that is still going on right now. And it was just so beautiful. And if I checked some of those Korean reaction through Twitter and SNS and the media, and it's overwhelming sense of joy and feeling of unity. And I think that President Moon Jae-in should really get a big credit for making this happen.
Colonel Anne Wright is also joining us from Hawaii. Anne, when you think back to September of 2017, not too long ago, you had President Trump using the opportunity of speaking before the world at the General Assembly to say he's prepared, or we, the United States, are prepared to, quote, totally annihilate, close quote, the country of North Korea. I mean, unusual, maybe unprecedented for a head of state to talk like that from the podium of what is considered the most important diplomatic moment in the UN's annual calendar. But that's wasn't the only utterance of Donald Trump. He's been threatening fire and fury, blah, blah, blah. And of course, Pence is pursuing the same hard line. While these Olympics are going on, I've seen that what you're doing is encouraging and helping to sponsor vigils maybe throughout the United States and perhaps all over the world to take advantage of this moment to show that the people of the world, not the governments, but the people of the world actually want peace, not war in Korea. Talk about that.
Well, that's right. The outrageous statements that the President of the United States has made on what the U.S. is certainly capable of doing, but horrific should the United States again wage war on North Korea, which we did so horribly in the Korean War, where we decimated the whole country of North Korea. I mean, it's outrageous, and it has mobilized people all over the world saying this is idiotic. Of course, we cannot have war. We've got to force these groups to dialogue. And now we see the North and South Korea dialoguing. And the United States is the odd country out on this, and as well as it should be. This should be an issue for the Korean people, both in North and South, to decide for themselves. And we're seeing that they are talking about it. The whole issue of Kim Jong-un's sister flying into Seoul is humongous. I mean, I can't imagine what the security groups of South Korea are doing. They must have had a heart attack when they found out she was going to come, because the security arrangements for her to be there have to be incredibly, incredibly strong. But it shows the dedication, I think, of now the North Korean government and the South Korean government saying, this is our time. And for the U.S. to be on the sidelines of it, I think is just fine. Let them decide what needs to happen. And the U.S. Has to go along with it. So I think things are moving in the right direction here. Thank you.
Professor Tim Beal, I was watching the opening ceremonies last night with my 13-year-old son, and I was explaining to him the significance of Kim Jong-un's sister being in South Korea. And his response was, wow, that's really a big deal. And it is a big deal. He went on to say that the Korean War is simply not taught anymore in American schools. Brian has said on this program many times that the Korean War is the forgotten war, at least here in the United States. It's certainly not forgotten in Korea. So explain to our listeners the import of this visit, the import of these contacts, and also tell us, if you can, if there's really a chance for forward progress with a hostile White House in Washington. Go ahead.
Well, a lot of questions there, John. I think I disagree with Anne to a certain extent when she said, you know, the United States on the sidelines. In one sense, that's true, but the United States is still, the big elephant in the room, the big power, the United States is the entity which can destroy North Korea, it would destroy South Korea in the process, et cetera, et cetera. So it can't be ignored. So what we're seeing is, as you said, the two Koreas coming together despite the United States. Now, the big question is whether that can be taken forward. You know, it's one thing to do it during the Olympics, and this is all very emotional, but it is a special occasion. The big question is whether Moon Jae-in can move forward after this, and despite the United States. So this is really the big question. It's in a sense, it's not South Korea again. It's not North Korea against the United States. It's South Korea against the United States. So Moon has to somehow stand up to American pressure, stand up to pressure from conservatives in South Korea, which is considerable, and move forward. And there's lots of things he can do. I mean, for instance, I was just reading a moment ago, the companies who were involved in the Kaesong Industrial Park. Now, that's the park in North Korean territory run by South Korean small businesses, small medium enterprises. And that was closed down a couple of years ago by Park Geun-hye. The question is, can he open that up again? The American government wouldn't be happy about that, but that would be a very positive sign that he is prepared to move forward. And there are many other things he could do as well, but to some extent, the initiative now is in his hands, and the question is, are those hands going to be steady enough? Is he going to be able to move forward?
Professor Chen, let's stay with the same subject. Does South Korea have sovereignty? Does it have the capacity, if it so chooses, to reach out to North Korea to limit or sort of reduce tensions on the Korean Peninsula, to develop a policy of détente or rapprochement, or what was known in 2000 and 2001 as the historic summit between Kim Dae-jung and Kim Jong-il, who was the leader of North Korea? There was a lot of euphoria, a lot of optimism back then. But you had, at least until 2001, you had Bill Clinton in the White House who seemed to be signaling Washington was good with it. He sent Madeleine Albright, the Secretary of State, to Pyongyang. So it looked like there was a liberal government in South Korea that wanted better relations. The North Koreans were reaching back. The Americans said, go for it. But now, as Professor Beal and Anne Wright are also saying, here you have the U.S. government either on the sidelines or professing animus towards the process. Can South Korea actually become truly sovereign if Moon Jae-in wants to go in a different direction than Washington?
Yes, I think he can, and he has already shown that he can, as we just saw the opening ceremony of the Olympics. As you know, this was President Moon's initiative, and even when he was running for as a president, he really thought that we can use the Pyeongchang Winter Olympic as the first step for inter-Korean engagement. And as you know, this was very, very difficult fight. And just looking at the pictures and the peaceful event, we somehow, this is beautiful. But all the work that have gone to reach this point, it is truly astounding. What it shows, what I'm trying to tell you, is that this was part of President Moon Jae-in and also many Koreans who thought about the alternate policy. This was part of the plan. So the first step is that you have a good result from the Korean unity from Pyeongchang Olympics. And the second step is making more gradual step and South Korean Special President Moon Jae-in can facilitate talks between North Korea and United States and building trust between United States and North Korea, and then slowly moving toward the more engagement and humanitarian exchanges and social, cultural, even sporting events, and then ultimately leading to some major talk between the United States and North Korea, eventually culminating and peace treaty. So I think that South Korea, yes, sovereignty is limited and has a great influence by United States. But what we show is that today, Today we show that we can, peace is possible. Peace is not given. Peace can be created. And also another thing I want to mention is that, as you saw today, it was the most amazing picture where Moon Jae-in shook hands with the North Korean leader's sister, Kim Yo-jong, and that this is itself is show that how what can be done when you have one leadership, right? And then one more thing I want to mention is that the amazing work that all the peace activists in the United States and us Korean Americans and have done so far. I really think that if we have not had such a movement, I don't think we would have seen this awesome event today.
And right, I'm wondering where Congress is in all of this. You know, we read the news avidly every day about both of the Koreas and finally this get together, what seems like a breakthrough, and we don't hear anything at all coming out of Washington unless it's coming out of the White House and it's talk of a bloody nose. Is there any other leadership in Washington that's focused on the Korea issue? And if so, where is it?
Well, we are certainly trying to get congressional resolution saying no first strike from the United States. I mean, some very basic things. It seems to me like a lot of our U.S. Congress people are still very hesitant about leaning forward, so to speak, on a peace on the Korean Peninsula. As Simone said, we have a major coalition of peace groups in the United States that have been working for the last 2 months to push Congress and to energize our public base keep pressing Congress on this and to press the White House too. So they do know that they're getting a lot of phone calls, a lot of emails, a lot of pressure saying you've got to support talks for peace. We're also attending things like the International Peace Conference in South Korea. I just came back from there just about 4 days ago, where there was a conference of 150 people primarily from South Korea, but the whole thing was about we need to keep pushing hard on all of our governments on this whole issue of peace.
Professor Beal, you know, it's quite interesting, the actual diplomatic pose adopted by Pence and the U.S. government at the Olympics. He's sitting, actually, was sitting just literally inches, maybe a foot or two away from Kim Jong-un's sister and Kim Jong-nam, who's a longtime top leader, very old now, of North Korea. Pence wanted to sit there so he could demonstrably not shake their hands, so he could demonstrably be in their presence, but without saying hello or shaking their hands. When you think about it, and you've been following this for a long time, it seems to me that what Pence and what Trump are trying to do is hold back the tide of progress. But the hearts and minds of the people both in Korea and around the world might be shifting. And not that they necessarily support the North Korean government, but people don't want war. They want peace. And it looks like the United States government is afraid that peace might break out in Korea. In other words, that's a bad pose to adopt in international affairs, especially when you're the leading, most important, or most militarily dominant power in the world. Talk about that, if you would.
Yeah, okay. Well, I mean, talking about not shaking hands, back in the 1950s, there was a famous occasion with John Foster Dulles, the Secretary of State, meeting Zhou Enlai, the Chinese foreign minister, at an international conference, Geneva or something like that, probably on Vietnam. And Zhou put out his hands to shake, and Dulles refused to shake hands with him. But, of course, Dulles was overtaken by history. As you say, people want peace. So there is this conflict between the desire of people for peace and the historical movements and governments who, in a sense, refuse to shake hands with peace. So we're seeing that again today. The American government, of course, doesn't want peace. It doesn't want peace in Korea. It doesn't want peace in Syria. War is big business, and so forth. And war keeps America, the dominant power in the world. So it's an ongoing struggle to try somehow to force the American government to move towards peace, and in this case to have serious negotiations with North Korea. Unfortunately, that doesn't seem to be on the cards at the moment. So whether President Moon can move the White House in that direction, and whether peace activists, whether Congress can, I don't know. But that's obviously what we all want.
Professor Chen, if I know you can't really answer this question, maybe it's a little bit silly as a question, but let me just ask you nonetheless. For the people in South Korea, do they view Kim Jong-un or Donald Trump as a graver threat to actual peace at this point and under these circumstances?
I think Koreans are very realistic. You know, Koreans have lived with the North Korea for obviously for more than 7 decades. And also Koreans, as you know, recently poll shows that, you know, no matter what Trump has done, and the Koreans' view of the United States is actually pretty favorable as well. So what I'm saying is that the Korean the electorate are very mature. This is democracy. This has become very mature democracy. People with a realistic, practical, pragmatic sense of what's going on and also what is possible, what is not possible. And I think that the candlelight revolution, which made the obviously led to President Moon's to success, is really the driving force. So I think peace, democracy will make peace. This is my argument. And also, I think if we improve the actual state of democracy in the United States and have maybe another leader or another Congress, we'll definitely help the Korean peace. And in a nutshell, it was ultimately up to the people, whether it's Koreans or Americans and who are democratically minded people, who will ultimately bring this, will bring peace in the Korean Peninsula. Yes, I think that, so to answer your question, whether somebody is considered, you know, as a leader, threat to the global peace, in a way, it will be a little bit of irrelevant. It is up to people, and I have full confidence in Korean people's ability to finally bring peace with the help of our great friends in the United States and all of the world.
Anne Wright, when you were at the State Department, I'm sure that you heard the term confidence-building measures quite often. It's something that diplomats always use when they're trying to bring two sides together. It seems like this is the perfect time for both North and South Korea to enact some confidence-building measures. Can you describe what those might be and whether we should expect to see them?
Indeed, this is the great time for it. And I think from the side of the South Koreans and the United States to continue the suspension of these large military exercises that the U.S. and South Korea have had. And from the North Korean side, to suspend any further testing of nuclear weapons and firing of ICBM missiles. If each side would do that, I think we would be on a pathway for good negotiations. And then a gradual lifting of sanctions that are detrimentally, horribly affecting the people of South Korea. I mean, it's very difficult for any humanitarian organization to get things in for like medical supplies and things like that, that really are exempt from the sanctions. But the U.S. is making it very, very difficult for these organizations to continue any type of operations in North Korea. Not that there are many of them to start with, but there are some very easy things, so to speak, to do that would certainly signal that all sides are ready to really work on finally a peace on the Korean Peninsula.
That's the voice of Anne Wright. She's a retired U.S. Army colonel and former U.S. State Department official in Afghanistan. She resigned in protest of George W. Bush's invasion of Iraq and became an anti-war activist. We're joined from New Zealand by author and professor Dr. Tim Beal. His most recent book is Crisis in Korea. And we're joined from Seattle by Professor Simone Chun. She's a fellow at the Korea Policy Institute and a member of the Korea Peace Network. Professor Beal, people in Washington, D.C. are listening to our show here in the Washington, D.C. metro area. Many of them probably don't know much about Korean history or even the Korean War. It's called the Forgotten War, unlike the Vietnam War. We had Mike Pence stopping off before he arrived in Seoul to meet Shinzo Abe, the principal ally of the United States. And of course, Shinzo Abe's his own family was involved in the colonization of Korea and the hunting down of Korean independence fighters. The Americans and people in the Washington area won't really understand what the impact of this kind of diplomacy actually has in South Korea. Can you comment on it?
That's an interesting point. Koreans, I mean, if there's any enmity by Koreans to anybody else in the world, and this includes North Korea as well, it's not so much the Americans, but it's the Japanese. The Japanese colonialism left a huge mark on Korean emotions, not merely for exploitation, but the cultural degradation of Korea. So Koreans were forced to take Japanese names and sort of de-Koreanize themselves and things like that. So this lingers on. It's very, very, very important. You mentioned Abe Shinzo. Now, his grandfather, his maternal grandfather, was one of the signatories of the declaration of war against the United States, the attack on Pearl Harbor. That, of course, has been sort of swept under the carpet. And Abe himself is very busy trying to remilitarize Japan, and he's very happy to stoke fires on the Korean Peninsula in order to further that. And he has, in fact, been talking about intervening in conflict in Korea. And that has aroused considerable anger in Korea, in Seoul. I think people in D.C. have to be conscious of these deep feelings in Northeast Asia. The war, Korean War might be forgotten in Washington. The Pacific War might be fairly semi-forgotten as well. But it isn't in East Asia. The Koreans remember it, North Korea, South Korea. The Chinese remember it, and throughout Southeast Asia. So there's a lot of concern about Japan, anger about the past, and concern about the future.
Let me bring in for our last comment, Professor Simone Chun. About 90 seconds left. I went to North Korea in 1989, Professor Chun, and I traveled through the country with a young South Korean woman, Im Suk Young. She was 21 years old, and for a daring go to North Korea, she was sentenced to 5 years at hard labor, and she did the 5 years at hard labor. But I can tell you, as we went through the villages in North Korea, just the idea that a South Korean person had made that trip, it aroused this mass enthusiasm and sentiment. The people poured out of their homes. I mean, literally thousands of people. We thought we were going to be trampled to death because they wanted to touch her. This isn't like Americans and the people in the world don't understand what it means to have 10 million divided families. 60 seconds left. Go ahead.
Yes, it's just such a heartbroken, and I feel heartbroken of thinking about all those families who can't even see themselves, right? And last thing I want to say is that we really have to remember this is one nation divided by other superpowers. And in the Olympic entrance, they sang the Arirang, which is a very iconic traditional song. It's about love affair. It's a missing. It's about family. It's a beloved friends. And I really think that I hope, and the Koreans will finally, from this point on, they're not going to return to the past of a war and division, and they will move forward. As President Moon Jae-in said today in the speech, he said, we are doing this for future generation. We have lived through it, but we're not going to leave divided Korea under the threat of war to our children. And I think this is the way I feel. I think we're going to stick to this path of peace, and I really, really hope
Excellent.
Our friends in the United States really help us.
I hear you. Excellent words. That's Professor Simone Chun. She's a fellow at the Korea Policy Institute. We talked to her from Seattle. Also, Anne Wright from Hawaii and Professor Tim Beal from New Zealand. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. In Washington, D.C. and around the country, in cities throughout this land, poor people and working class people and people of color are being moved out of the urban areas. Longtime city residents face higher rents and increased pressure from landlords and developers. The nation's capital is no exception, and two groups taking the fight to a developer's own home this weekend with a march up a main D.C. street in Upper Northwest. We're joined in studio by Yasmina Marabit, a housing organizer with One D.C., a leading organization and the group that put together Saturday's march, and by Will Merrifield, an attorney with the Washington Legal Clinic for the Homeless, who is representing the tenants of Congress Heights. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Will Merrifield, let's start with you. You're an attorney with the Washington Legal Clinic for the Homeless. This is an unusual tactic, and I'm sure the developer's not going to be that happy about it. It's a march on his house. Why this tactic?
Well, for one, I think that it's important that, you know, the organizers and the tenants are the lead in the tactics for what's happening. And, you know, the tenants, they feel very strongly that it's that they want to take this fight to the slumlord's house that's having them live in terrible conditions, that's usurping their legal rights, and that's trying to drive them out of their community. So they don't think that he should be able to have them live with the things they have to live with while he sits in basically a gated community in Cleveland Park and doesn't have to own any of these actions.
Yasmina, where does the demonstration begin? How do people get there?
So people can meet us at 12 p.m. at Cleveland Park Metro, and we're going to march from there to Jeff Griffiths' house. And just to add on to what Will said, many of the big players behind these displacement projects across the city, they're able to maintain anonymity to the general public. And so what we're saying is you can't be a slumlord, and you can't run these displacement projects and cut all these deals behind the scenes and be anonymous. Everybody's going to know who you are, and you're going to be exposed for, you know, your slumlord activities.
And who's coming to the demonstration?
Of course, we're going to have tenant leaders from Congress Heights that are going to be leading the march. We have people that are with 1DC and with Justice First, which is the lead organizing group that's been working with the Congress Heights tenants since all of this began about 5 years ago. We're going to have people from many different ally organizations, Empower DC, People Power Action. A lot of different groups around the city have been supporting the Congress Heights tenants throughout this fight. Congress Heights tenants recognize that this is not just about their particular property. This is about the affordable housing crisis in Washington, D.C., and the fact that people are being priced out of the city, and the fact that public housing is being privatized, and the fact that in a situation like this, where the tenants have a nonprofit developer willing to work with them to build 200 units of affordable housing, every major political entity that has the power to sway things in their direction to make that plan happen has chosen to side with a slumlord. And so it's important for people across the city to come together and expose that, because there are ways to solve the housing crisis. But, you know, people in power, the political actors that are in power, are not taking steps to do so because they're putting money over people.
Well, up until the 1980s, the Washington, D.C. area was a majority African-American city. It was perhaps one of the most largest African-American populations in an urban area, percentage-wise, in the country. You also had Newark, we have Detroit, not alone. But Washington, D.C. was essentially an African-American city with an African-American leadership. Today, the African-American population is less than 50%. So there's this correlation between race and class, where you have working class people being forced out because of the policies of the developers and the banks. And those working class people are also black people. And so there's the toxic combination of class domination and also racism. Is that how the tenants view it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the tenants understand that and not just the tenants at Congress Heights, but different tenants that I work with at Brooklyn Manor and places all over the city understand that there's a real sense that people are under attack. And when Yasmina's talking about, you know, these people being slumlords, they are slumlords. But I think people have this idea of what a slumlord is in their head. It may be from that, like, Joe Pesci movie from the 1980s.
Sure, that's true.
these are very, you know, wealthy, politically connected people that aren't just, you know, sitting on buildings in order to, you know, collect small rents. They're investing in these properties with the idea that they're waiting for capital to flood into these areas. And once capital floods into these areas, they flip the properties.
So
they demolish.
It's a speculative market.
It's completely speculative. It's planned displacement. To Yasmina's point, the government, the local government, is complicit with these developers. And the idea is they want to change entire communities, change the character of entire communities, build things very dense for a very specific group of people. And those people are not the individuals that live there now. So, yes, there is a very clear sense by tenants that they are under attack. The schools are under attack. Their housing's under attack. You know, the cultural nature of the city's under attack.
I want to come back to the issue of the speculative market because, of course, that drives a capital investment where you can see, or the investor can see, huge, maybe by a magnitude of 50 or sometimes 100, the value of a property going up. And thus, it's not a real value, but of course, they don't care about real or not real. They care about money. I want to come back to that issue, but let's go back to the label slumlord. So the slumlord is an invective. It's an adjective. It's certainly perhaps perceived by some as a rhetorical flourish. But Yasmina, you're with the tenants at Brooklyn Manor. You're with poor tenants around the city. Why does the slumlord label fit?
I mean, the slumlord label fits because what these developers are doing is they're allowing properties to deteriorate and allowing tenants to experience slum conditions in hopes of more easily pushing them out. So if you have tenants living in a situation where they're paying rent, some people like $1,000 a month to live with, you know, sewage coming up out of their bathtub drains and, you know, leaks from the apartments above them and mold, you know, throughout their walls, then, you know, the developer's hope is to wear people down and to make people just say, you know, I just can't live under these conditions anymore. I'm just going to leave. I'm just going to, you know, take whatever, you know, whatever offer they might make. But the tenants at Congress Heights have stood strong and they've refused. You know, they've called the offers that that Griffiths has made them, Jeff Griffiths, who's the slumlord whose house we're going to on Saturday. They've called it kibbles and bits, you know, what they're being offered. And you know, the slumlords are called that because that is the tactic that they're using to push people out. It's not like they can't, you know, keep these properties well maintained. It's just that they don't have an interest in doing so.
They want to say, but go ahead.
Well, I was just to say on Yasmina's point when she talks about sewage coming out of the bathtubs, that's not that actually happened at these properties. There, when I first went to the properties, there was raw sewage in the basement. And these are people, you know, working people, the people that have worked their whole lives. A lot of the tenants at Congress Heights are seniors who have worked their whole lives, are in these places that are affordable, but not really affordable, even though like there's this market with these properties that are not kept up. The rent is still pretty expensive. You know, the rent's still between $900 and $1,000 a year. And
a month.
I'm sorry. And there are a lot of units. This is sort of a delving into something a little bit deeper into this topic, but a lot of these units were being rented by the slumlord to residents being exited out of the city's shelter system and being placed in these units with government subsidies.
Okay, so let's delve a little bit further into that. So there are homeless people, and there's a lot of homeless people here in Washington. You just walk out on K Street every morning. There's people sleeping, and even in the most despicable weather conditions, people are just huddled together. Many of the homeless are workers. They're employed, but they can't pay the first month's rent and a security deposit and that which is necessary to even get started. So they're just frozen out of the housing market. So the city takes people who are homeless and puts them in shelters, but in order to transition them from the shelter to an apartment, what you're saying is that the city then becomes the subsidizing agent for the landlords who take the tenants in, the homeless, the low income or very, very low income or no income, put them in, they're subsidized. The landlord gets a lot of money from the city, from our taxpayers, and then they don't fix up the apartments. In fact, they sabotage the apartments. They deliberately don't carry out repairs, and thus then they drive these same people back out of the apartments, and thus that property becomes available for inside of a very inflated speculative market to be sold to others.
Absolutely. So if you're Sanford Capital, exactly what you just described, if you're Sanford Capital, the individuals who own this property, the entity that own this property, you buy this property, they bought it for, I think, $2.5 million. A prime piece of real estate over the metro. Then they had a lot of people who were in the property when they bought them. As units became vacant, they started backfilling them with individuals being exited from the shelter system. And while these people were being exited from the shelter system into these units, they were charging the government a lot of money for these units.
Like, so how much? Do you know?
Between $1,400 and $1,800 a month.
So we, the taxpayers, pay the landlords vis-a-vis this arrangement.
Yeah, for units with raw sewage in the basement, with mold infestations, with cockroaches, the whole nine yards. And then when they want to flip the property, because across the street from this site, it's the St. Elizabeth's redevelopment, with people who live in Washington, D.C. might have heard, hundreds of millions of dollars from the city. So again, taxpayer money are going to subsidize developers to build luxury units and transform St. Elizabeth's, a giant, you know, parcel of land. They're putting in $65 million for a practice facility for the Washington Wizards across the street from this property. So as that capital gets injected into the community, then the slumlord, the developer who owns this place, wants to up the ante on the poor conditions in the property in order to force people out and then flip that property. So right now, so they bought that property for $2.5 million. Right now, you could not get a assessment on that property from a bank that says it's worth more than $3 million. Tops. That's stretching it. They think the property is worth $120 million.
But to do that, they have to get rid of the tenants.
They have to get rid of the tenants. So this is the power of the tenants in this process, is that if the tenants stay in the property and the tenants control the land in their community by not being driven out of these properties, then the tenants can start to control the land in their community and push back against this rampant displacement, this rampant gentrification of these communities.
I mean, that's a rough road, though, because you have tenants who are living in sewage with, you know, probably rodents and all sorts of other health hazards. Mold, Yasmina, you mentioned, which, of course, can not just only deteriorate your health, it can kill you. That's a rough road for low-income people to say, in spite of everything, we're going to stay in the apartment so the slum lord, the real estate developer, can't actually realize the speculative value, so-called, of the property. That's a rough road.
It's an extremely rough road. That's why when we started this segment, you said, wow, we marched in this guy's house. Because, I mean, the fight for this, one, people in the community have to be in solidarity with the tenants. So that's why we want everyone to come out to this march on Saturday. To be in complete solidarity with these tenants that are fighting this fight, not only for themselves at Congress Heights, but for the entire community. They're not just fighting their fight for themselves. Their fight is for 200. There's 13 tenants left in this property. Everybody else has been driven out. They're fighting for 200 units of affordable housing. They have a nonprofit developer lined up that will build 200 units of affordable housing over this site if they're able to exercise a legal right that they have, which the landlord is trying to thwart them for being able to exercise. So one, people have to be in solidarity. Two, lawyers like myself have to legally try to provide some relief to these sorts of, you know, conditions issues, and do what we can to make the landlord adhere to the law and have these people live in habitable conditions. And third, organizers like Yasmina, One, D.C., Eugene Puryear, who the listeners might know, has been instrumental in organizing and a leader, being the leader in this fight. So we, as an organizing base, have to come together, because at the end of the day, these fights won't be won in a court of law. In the courts, we can slow things down. We can try to make sure that tenants' rights are being respected. But at the end of the day, this displacement is political. This is a political decision by the local government to side with and subsidize developers at the expense of communities. All the hundreds of million dollars they're investing in luxury development can be invested in workforce development, in schools, in existing communities, to inject capital into existing communities instead of erasing those communities and building luxury redevelopment.
Those are important words, because I think the developers and the banks and the politicians all want to convince people that this road, this path, this policy is the only path, the only policy. It's almost as if it's, it has a divine sort of intervention. God wanted...
manifest destiny.
Yeah, manifest destiny. And the inevitability becomes a political factor, because it tells those who don't have political power, guess what? You can't win. You can't fight. You can't succeed against City Hall. So I think it's extremely important what Will Merrifield is saying here, that through the exercise of solidarity, through the exercise of grassroots organizing, through the exercise of people, lawyers, providing legal assistance, that there can be another way. And here we are 50 years after the killing of Dr. King, 50 years after the Poor People's Campaign, which enshrined some of those same organizing concepts. People are mobilizing here in Washington, D.C. and around the country to do just that. And as a matter of fact, to take the occasion of the 50th anniversary to build this movement into a grassroots but nationwide movement. Yasmina, I want to go to another element of this struggle, which I think, I really believe most people, unless you're living in these housing complexes, most people just don't know what's actually going on. The tenants are not only facing sabotage by the real estate developers and the landlords, making sure that their things that need repair aren't repaired. They're also facing harassment and coercion. I mean, real harassment. You're at Brooklyn Manor organizing the tenants there. Talk about what the developers and what the real estate sort of lords are doing in terms of just harassing people at their own homes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so at Brooklyn Manor, and just to go back to something that you said earlier about race and class, I mean, these displacement projects are an attack not just on Black people, but specifically on working class Black people. And when tenants at Brooklyn Manor met with the one of the executives of the developer there, Mid-City Financial, he stated, it's not just about economics, it's about sociology. And that is clearly an important point and element of what's happening. But in terms of harassment at Brooklyn Manor, it's a different situation from Congress Heights, in the sense that the tactics that they chose to employ were to institute new community rules. Those are things like, you can't stand on the grass, you can't lean on the fence, you can't dry a carpet outside, you can't smoke a cigarette outside, you can't, if you're standing on the sidewalk talking to your neighbor, they have a private police force that is armed, and they patrol the property, and they work with MPD, and they'll come up to you. And I've been harassed by them on several occasions where they'll say, you're incommoding, you're blocking passage, even if no one else is around and you're just standing there talking to people, which is what you have to do when you're organizing. So what they do is they'll send people notices of infraction for violating community rules. And then they'll use those notices of infraction as a basis for evicting people. And through those kinds of methods, they can evict large numbers of people. There was one tenant who received two notices of infraction for sitting outside, and it showed her violation. There was a picture of her, and it was a picture of her literally sitting outside. And then they sent her, the second notice, same thing, picture of her sitting outside. And they sent a notice to vacate, which indicated that they were initiating a potential eviction process. So if she didn't cure the violation in 30 days, meaning not sit outside for 30 plus days, then they were going to proceed with evicting her. So those are the kinds of, harassment tactics that people are facing at Brooklyn Manor.
Yeah, and just a bit on what Yasmina said. So they're basically creating a police state at Brooklyn Manor, wherein people can't gather outside and just relax, have a beer, smoke a cigarette. But if you walk 4 blocks down the street from Brooklyn Manor, they're building a walkable, livable neighborhood, as you know, these developers call it, where what is encouraged? People sitting, young professionals sitting outside, having a beer, you know, relaxing, building, you know, what these developers were building, community, you know. But you walk 4 blocks up the street, and if working class Black people are engaging the exact same activity, they have a private police force busting their heads. So that's the situation we're in. It's a situation where certain activity is criminalized due to a person's class and race. And this is, these policies are completely supported by politicians in Washington, D.C. I mean, they are working hand in glove with these developers because these developers are paying for their reelection campaigns. So housing policy in Washington, D.C., which seems completely chaotic because everybody's talking about Washington, D.C. has a unique problem. It has a surplus that it can't spend. Yet, even though we have this giant surplus in our local budget, we have extreme affordable housing crisis. And how can those two things, you know, match? They match because developers are in charge of housing policy, because they are the people who are getting politicians elected. So politicians are just tools. They are not in charge of anything. They are being told what to do. So when we're asking Mayor Bowser to turn over a parcel of land that sits on the Congress Heights parcel, that if it's an abandoned building that the city controls, not only does the city control an abandoned building on the edge of this Congress Heights parcel, there is a $920,000 outstanding loan on that piece of property that says it has to be used for affordable housing. If the city assigned that parcel of land to us, it would leverage our ability to gain control of the entire parcel and take the property from the slumlord. That's because the property, if we control that tiny abandoned parcel that the city controls, if they assign that to us, then the property is not upzoned, meaning the value of the property goes down significantly. The city, to this point, has not taken that very simple step to do that. And why haven't they taken it? Because it's not Mayor Bowser's decision. She is controlled by the powers that be.
But she could take that decision.
She could. She could. She absolutely could. And that, I mean, that is why we're on the street, because this is about reclaiming democracy and creating real political will by saying, Mayor, if you don't do this, you will not, your political power will be reduced because people will see you as a fraud that is being controlled by these developers.
That's the voice of Will Merrifield. He is an attorney with the Washington Legal Clinic for the Homeless. He's representing tenants of Congress Heights. We're also talking in studio with Yasmina Morabit, housing organizer with 1DC, a leading organization that's organizing a demonstration tomorrow. And again, for our listeners, Eugene Puryear, who is the host of By Any Means Necessary here on Radio Sputnik, is also a major central leader and organizer of this struggle for the tenants in Congress Heights. And beyond the tenants there, for poor people and working class people, low-income people who are being literally driven out of Washington, D.C. Yasmina, Washington is a tale of two cities. I just made that up.
It's very true.
It is a tale of two cities. We have the growing affluence in this city and in the metro D.C. area, mainly after 9/11 because of war contracting and the growth of the surveillance state. But at the same time, you have the broad majority of working class people and their families who have lived here literally for more than a century, sometimes more than that, who are being driven out. And it's a relentless war. And I want to go back to what Will stated, or Will made the point. It is in some ways about the land. Whose land is it? Again, we have this assumption in this, you know, this particular economic model that the landlords and the real estate developers and the banks, it's their land. Like, that's the conception. They have legal title to it. Maybe they don't even sometimes. But talk about the land.
Yeah, I mean, it's about who controls the land, who decides what happens on the land, who decides what is a community benefit, who decides what protects the health, safety, and welfare of the community. And, you know, in a city where the mayor's solution to the affordable housing crisis is to privatize public housing and allow private entities to take control over public land in order to build whatever they want, in order to profit. And like in the case of Brooklyn Manor, you have Maddie Ford, who's the director of their legal affairs, who had a quote that said, you know, the smaller the unit, the more units we can build, the more profits we can make, period. And so they're not building on the basis of what is good for a community.
Or a family, certainly.
Or a family, definitely not. They're building based on what will make them the most money. So, yeah, I mean, it is a question of how much does the government allow private property owners to do whatever they want at the expense of the community? And with, you know, there is a zoning commission, the DC Zoning Commission, which is a government entity which is comprised of people that are appointed by the mayor that are supposed to be looking at these developers' plans and saying, we approve these as community benefits or we don't. And the zoning commission approves 99.99% of proposals that come in front of them. So, you know, it's basically a free for all for the so-called owners of these properties. But, you know, a lot of the tenants at Brooklyn Manor will say by now, you know, we should own a piece of this land because we've been paying into it for like 40 years. And beyond that, all of the subsidies that Mid-City has been receiving, you know, from the government that's also the public's money. So, you know, it's a corporation that's able to use private property rights to get rich off of workers, off of working class people.
We have about a minute left, Will. I want to just ask you, Frances Perkins, who was the Secretary of Labor for Roosevelt, the first woman to be in a cabinet in the United States, she made the argument that workers have a property right in their job. And that was at the time that workers were carrying out sit down strikes all over the country because of the depression caused by not them, but by the other class that owned the factories and the banks. What about the idea that there's an interjection of property rights, even for tenants, in the face of landlord assaults?
There, I mean, not only is that conceptually that I agree with that, but there's an actual law in Washington, D.C. called the Tenant Opportunity to Purchase Act that codifies that. And that is, at Congress Heights, what this developer is trying to thwart. They're trying to thwart the tenants from being able to exercise this right. Because if they did, the legal jargon of it is too complicated to get into. But basically, if they're giving a notice that they have a legal right to, we can take control of this property legally and build 200 units of affordable housing.
And it also means the value of the building might be $3 million instead of $103
Absolutely.
Million, and thus the speculative attraction for bankers and hedge funds goes away. In
Absolutely.
Other words, workers and tenants come first.
Exactly.
That's right.
I think we're going to leave it right there. We've been joined in studio by Yasmina Morabit, a housing organizer with ONEDC, a leading organization that's organizing a demonstration tomorrow starting at Cleveland Park at 12 noon and marching to the home of Jeff Griffiths. And we've been joined by Will Merrifield, an attorney with the Washington Legal Clinic for the Homeless, who is representing the tenants of Congress Heights. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.